So if you press him, this morning's speaker likes to distinguish his sunny, agreeable California style from that of his crankier, snarkier East Coast colleagues. But don't be fooled. Underneath it all, he is a truly defiant soul. His work is premised on challenging the general trend of our field for 100 years or more, in which the core of therapy has been seen as a focus on all the pain, the trauma, the suffering that are so endemic to our human species. In contrast, our speaker's radical clinical premise is that often as not, clients have already achieved the states of equanimity, balance, even joy that they say they are seeking right there before our eyes. It's not just that we don't notice them when they happen, partly because they may occur so fleetingly, but even more so because we therapists are so drawn to exploring the deep muddy of whatever psychic mess has transpired in their life. But this is not just positive thinking or your father's positive psychology. Rick has developed his ideas about therapy and change from a deep and wide-ranging knowledge of neurobiology, mindfulness practice, and evolutionary psychology. He knows better than most of us in this field just how unnatural a steady state of contentment is for our species. And he knows through both his personal experience and his several decades of clinical practice just how hard it is to convince our recalcitrant, gloom-driven brains to try a little happiness. And what sets him apart is he had looked deeply into the very roots of our biological history to answer the question of why the therapist's task can often appear so difficult. The fact is, unpleasant though it has always been, being afraid, angry, sad, and suspicious much of the time prevented our ancient forebears, whether four-legged or two-legged, from being eaten alive. As a system of species preservation, it ain't pretty, but it works. It allowed our animal and human forebears, and ultimately us, to live and procreate another day. The good news, according to Rick, is that while our brains may be biased towards negativity, they are also miraculously plastic. We can use our minds to change and mold our brains in ways that make us better able to avoid chronic anxiety and depression, achieve more self-control and inner calm, savor and initiate love, gratitude, compassion, and joy. And on a personal note, I must add that during this long, cruel, unrelenting winter, talking with Rick in preparation for this conference had the effect of temporarily reversing 200,000 years of evolutionary negativity for me. In spite of the fact that I repeatedly shoveled a truly Himalayan amount of snow and had the flu for a month, and my favorite supermarket discontinued ordering my favorite low-fat Greek yogurt, simply talking with Rick and feeling the radiance of his optimism and his calm good humor, I could just feel those happiness neurons perking up and pinging new connections with each other. It may have been dark and cold and snowy out there, but in here, at least during my chats with Rick, there was a positive fiesta going on. How does he do it? Among the many blessings in life that you were previously unaware of, you were about to experience one more. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you this morning's speaker, Rick Hansen.
Thank you. Wow. I feel like I have to overcome so much now. I have to like really establish my negativity cred. Like I can be miserable too, you know. Not just because I'm from California. Anyway. Well. Okay. So, I want to definitely thank Rich Simon, one of my benefactors, as well as the other organizers of the conference, and you all for being here. This is the largest live audience I've ever spoken before. I'm kind of nervous about it. I think about the two rules of public speaking: show up, don't suck. Right? It's kind of a low bar. I like that it's a low bar. It's kind of reassuring. So, to the end of not sucking, I hope to explore with you four topics here. The first, briefly, will be about the amazing fact that we actually can use our minds to change our brains, to change our minds for the better, to benefit ourselves and other beings. That's self-directed neuroplasticity. Second, since it's, I think, time to step back a little bit in terms of our field's fascination with brain science, really consider the strengths and the weaknesses, the benefits and the pitfalls of bringing neuroscience into psychotherapy. And then I'm going to focus on a particular application, a particular benefit of bringing brain science into the clinical field, broadly defined, having to do with personal healing, everyday well-being and effectiveness, personal growth, even the upper reaches of human potential. One of the special benefits, I think, of bringing neuroscience into the general territory of clinical practice and psychological growth altogether is to zero in on something that we kind of sort of already knew, but had, I think, underappreciated. And that is the critical importance in any context of growth, which involves learning, of course, the critical importance of turning passing mental states into some kind of lasting trait for there to be any sort of lasting benefit, growth, or value. And without really addressing that installation phase of learning in which our experiences move out of short-term memory buffers effectively into long-term storage, without really paying attention to that installation phase, the positive experiences that are often hard-won in our clients and in our own lives wash through the brain like water through a sieve, while, due to the negativity bias that Rich mentioned, negative experiences get routinely caught and turned into neural structure. And then that will take me into the fourth subject here, taking in the good. I'll explore this material more in my workshops. It's, you know, it's an hour. It's kind of condensed. I will end very close to on time at 10:30. And you're also very welcome to take a look at the material that's freely offered on my website, rickhansonson.net, that has tons of freely offered resources. Okay, to it. Here we go. Self-directed neuroplasticity. Got to, of course, start with the brain. Doesn't look like much. I always think of it as rotten cauliflower, sort of, you know, 3 pounds of tofu-like tissue inside the coconut. And yet, even though it doesn't look like much, to scientists, it's often considered to be the most complex physical object currently known. It contains about 1.1 trillion cells, roughly 10% of which, 100 billion or so, are neurons, these little on-off switches, like transistors inside the brain. A typical neuron makes about 5,000 connections on average with other neurons, giving us a network inside our head with 500 trillion little nodes called synapses that are so tiny you could put roughly 5,000 synapses side by side in the width of a single human hair. All right. So what's the purpose of all this fancy hardware? You know, these neurons are typically firing 5 to 50 times a second. Even though the brain is just 2 to 3% of body weight, it tends to use around 20 to 25% of the oxygen and glucose circulating in our blood. Why would Mother Nature have evolved such an expensive organ? Well, the fundamental function of the nervous system is to process information. In other words, we have a physical system, the nervous system, this material, that represents non-physical information. And the totality of the information in the nervous system is more or less what neuroscientists and neuropsychologists, I think, as well, mean by the word mind, or related words like mental, or cognitive, or psychological. This is the territory of mind altogether, only a tiny fraction of which is accessible to us consciously. We privilege what's in the field of conscious awareness because it's what we know, but it's really a very small part. It's the tip of the iceberg of all mental processing. Okay. In this context, in this frame, this is the natural frame. Apart from the workings of transcendental X factors, supernatural influences, we're left with, frankly, the meat. So in that context then, which is the natural frame of science, mental activity entails neural activity. It requires underlying neural activity. For example, this is an image of a Tibetan monk who's stuck in an MRI, you know, claustrophobic, loud, banging away, and he's sending boundless compassion to all beings, right? Well, to do that, he's got to concentrate. So a part of the brain that performs that function in this image over there and there, the cingulate cortex, that's the orange blob that you see there, it's very involved, this part of the brain, in the top-down executive control of attention. So if you deliberately pay attention, or even better, do metacognition, where you're paying attention to attention, you're drawing upon the cingulate cortex. And because mental activity is drawing upon that particular part of the brain that supports that mental activity, paying attention deliberately, being very mindful, well, that part of the brain is working harder. And because it's working harder, it needs more metabolic supplies, thus it can show up on an MRI as consuming more oxygen. All right, so that's an illustration, one illustration, there are many more, of the ways in which as the mind changes, so must the brain as well. Now, that's a temporary change. That's a momentary change. In terms of lasting changes, which is where we really start thinking about how clinical practice or other life learning experiences leave lasting changes inside our brain, we realize that, you know, repeated patterns of mental activity entail repeated patterns of neural activity, and repeated patterns of neural activity leave lasting changes in the brain in terms of structure and function. All right? As is summarized in the famous saying from the work of the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb, neurons that fire together wire together. I swear someone's going to do a rap song. It's going to be rich. People pay me not to sing. I won't be doing it. But neurons that fire together wire together. You know, you just got to feel it. It's going to be happening here. I swear to you. Okay. So these days, there are thousands of studies on humans and animals that document the ways in which the animal's experiences, including a very complicated top-of-the-food-chain animal like a human being, that our experiences, our thoughts, our feelings, our perceptions, our sensations, our hopes, our sorrows, our joys, our suffering, all of that is continually changing the structure of the brain for better or worse. In one study, Sarah Lazar and her colleagues took a look at long-term mindfulness meditators and compared them to matched controls. And Lazar and her colleagues out of Harvard found that mindfulness meditators, not perfect meditators, like regular people, you know, 20 minutes a day, 40 minutes tomorrow, feeling cocky, skip a few days, start feeling guilty. Okay, how many of you do something meditative 1 minute or more a month? 1 minute or more a month. It's a low bar, another low bar, good. No more personal questions. Okay, you have a feeling for what I'm talking about. All right, fine. They weren't perfect, but they're pretty focused still. Nonetheless, they actually changed their brains in three key regions. Number one, the insula on the inside of the temporal lobes, which is very involved in tuning into the body, interoception, tracking our feelings, our gut feelings especially, as well as a kind of bonus, empathy for the emotions of others. Second region, prefrontal regions right behind the forehead that are involved in executive control of attention, impulses, and emotions. And then the third region, somatosensory cortex at the top of the head, that's involved in tuning into the body. Well, no surprise, what do meditators do, especially mindfulness meditation? They tune into their bodies, right, tracking their inner state, and are regulating attention and staying centered in the process. So they repeatedly activated those parts of the brain. They lit them up, as it were. And since they activated those parts of the brain, since they stimulated activity there, they gradually built neural structure. Somewhat like the metaphor of repeatedly working a particular muscle. You know, if you lift weights this way a lot, I guess your bicep will grow, and lift weights that way a lot, I don't know, your tricep will grow, I don't know. I go rock climbing, but otherwise exercise. You know, every so often I get the urge to exercise, but I lie down until it passes. Yeah. That old line, right? That's a good one. Okay, so here's the bottom line. We can use the mind, as I said at the very beginning, to change the brain, to change the mind for the better, to benefit ourselves and all beings. And to me, that's the fundamental takeaway point of what Jeffrey Schwartz at UCLA has called self-directed neuroplasticity. Now, with that kind of power to change our brains, the most important, the central, fundamental organ in the body. You know, if we go into a hazardous situation, Mother Nature will shut down all other systems before she finally diverts resources away from the brain. So with the kind of power to be able to influence and affect that part of the brain, that part of the body, the brain, comes great responsibility. A little bit later, I'll talk about how we as individuals can use that power for our own benefit and for those that we work with. But meanwhile, I'd like to step back and think about what can our profession do with the power it has to use the mind to change the brain for the better. And I'd like to use that as a way to look at the strengths and the weaknesses, the benefits and the pitfalls in bringing neuroscience into psychotherapy. Now, first the good news, all right, the strengths, okay? Brain science has led to genuine innovations, truly new developments in our field, such as neurofeedback, certain protocols for not just overwriting traumatic memories, but actually erasing them. That's good. A second benefit of bringing neuroscience into the realm of psychotherapy has been as an organizing framework. In the Tower of Babel-like world sometimes of psychotherapy, you know, we have 1,000 languages and 10,000 protocols. We only have one brain, which enables us to realize sometimes that we might be using the same words to mean different things in terms of neural processing, or using different language to refer to the same fundamental underlying neurological process. Third major benefit of bringing brain science into psychotherapy is that it's motivating, right? Instead of it being some kind of airy-fairy, excuse me, Rich, California sort of thing, you know, like getting our feelings on and all the rest of that, we're changing the meat. You know, then our suggestion for someone can feel very tangible, very, very concrete, and thus motivating for individuals in the larger context of what Freud called the impossible profession. For us as therapists, it's heartening to know that we're actually, what we do in the messy world of clinical practice can actually be changing the brain for the better. And God help us, who knows, maybe even insurance providers will be more motivated to, support what we do. Okay. Fourth major benefit, in many ways I think probably the most fundamental benefit of bringing neuroscience into our field over the last 10, even 20 years, has been to highlight what someone somewhere already knew in the general territory of psychology and clinical practice, but we had maybe forgotten or not foregrounded in our awareness. I think it's sometimes interesting that a field such as our own that often pays such attention to an individual's personal history can often be so forgetful about its own history. And then we have the phenomenon, of course, which we have to watch out for, I'll get to that momentarily, of old wine, you know, in fancy new bottles. And one of the particular ways in which I think that highlighting and re-emphasizing what's already been known in our field so that it would be inappropriate to say, oh, I invented that, an area that's important to highlight is this business of the fundamental neuropsychology of learning. Psychotherapy is a process of learning, if it's anything. How do people learn? I think we've been very preoccupied with what people learn, but the universal underlying question of how is relevant to all the various whats that we're trying to help people learn. Right? And it's very clear that in the underlying how of learning, if we don't pay attention to the conversion of fleeting mental states into lasting neural structure, they're momentarily pleasant, but they wash through the brain, which is a major focus that I'll be coming back very soon. But that's the dessert, that's the good stuff, the cherry pie, a la mode, something like that, of my little talk here. We've got to eat our vegetables first, all right? Now the pitfalls, all right? But before I actually get to the pitfalls, I want to quote from T.S. Eliot, because I think sometimes that, as he says here, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place truly for the first time. Of course, that takes work, right? As George Orwell writes here, to see what is in front of one's nose takes a constant struggle. So it's been deeply useful for me to see what's been in front of my nose all along, which is this real importance in helping my clients learn, in helping the good lessons and good experiences of life, the beneficial lessons and experiences of life, really, really, really stick to someone's ribs. But before getting into that, the dessert, like I warned you, pitfalls. Okay? First pitfall, I think, my opinion, and by the way, I have fallen into every one of these pits. You know, there's a saying in medicine, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. I've had a lot of experience, all right? Okay. So it takes one to know one when I go through these pitfalls. So first pitfall, oversimplifying. You know, the language of neuroscience is very catchy. It's compelling. Mirror neurons, the God gene, the female brain. You know, like, wow. You know, you just use words like that or phrases. You suddenly feel smarter, okay? And we have to be very careful about that. Take empathy, for example, mirror neurons. Yes, mirror-like networks and the perceptual motor circuitry of the brain do give us some sense over here. They simulate, as it were, over here, some internal sense of what that person over there could be experiencing while engaging in action. That's an important part of empathy. But other parts of the brain are involved in other very important aspects of empathy. For example, the insula, which I mentioned previously, supports empathy for the emotions, the feelings of others. That enables us to resonate with people emotionally. Also, theory of mind functions enable us to simulate the thoughts, the motivations, the ways in which personality factors are in play, the ways in which someone's life history is at work. And those functions that enable us to empathize with thoughts, broadly defined, are supported by circuits, you know, essentially behind the forehead that come online, you know, more or less around the third or fourth birthday. So it's not that mirror neurons are unimportant or mirror-like networks are unimportant, but they're not the be-all and end-all of empathy, and I think there's been a tendency, just to use that as an example, to make them the be-all and end-all of empathy when they're really not. So second major pitfall is adding little new meaning. And if you read an article in the popular press, right? Or in, God help us, the pages of Psychotherapy Networker, you know, and you find that you can take the neurolingo and just replace it with ordinary, good, old school psychological terms, and there's no real loss of meaning, right? There's no loss of pragmatic benefit or value. Huh, what was the point of all that kind of fancy language in the first place? Now, sometimes the point of all that fancy language is to impress people. I know this from the inside out. You know, to claim authority, you know, in the secular religion of the West is science. You want to, I swear sometimes, if you want to sell used cars, put on a white lab coat. If you want to really jack sales up further, wear a stethoscope around your neck to sell your Hyundais or what have you. You know, so in a field, psychotherapy, that's, you know, classically been sort of the poor, unwanted cousin. My dad grew up on a ranch in North Dakota. He used terms like the runt of the litter, you know, way in the back. You know, in that larger context, it's so tempting, isn't it, to claim that authority of science. You know, I've been like at the end of a long day, or I'm embarrassed to say sometimes at the beginning of a good day, I've just been frustrated with a client and said, listen, it's your amygdala. You know, okay, doc, all right, I'll do what you say now, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, I think we have to be a little careful of the temptations, as it were, to claim this kind of authority, all right? And then last and not least, neuroscience can lead us in our fascination with the brain to underestimate the mind. And it's important to remember that mental plasticity, the capacity of the brain to represent a vast range of thoughts and feelings, joys and sorrows, without producing any kind of structural change, mental plasticity is much, much greater, than neuroplasticity, all right? It's so easy to forget the fact that we know so much in our own field. The wisdom of our profession, our own profession is nested in a larger wisdom stream, both secular and spiritual, you know, reaching back thousands of years. And I think that notwithstanding the fact that, you know, I've been very saturated in neuroscience for a long time now, you know, the more I know about the hardware, the more I appreciate the software and the capacities of people to work with the software without needing any particular reference to the actual brain. Okay. So, still, there are places where brain science really does add particular value. And in my own view, as I've said before, I think one of the particular areas where it adds a special value is drawing our attention back to the fundamental processes of learning, the how of personal growth altogether. and for growing inner strengths, very broadly defined. Inner strengths like mindfulness, the strengths that enable us to simply be with our experience, to bear our own pain without trying to change one whit of it, to feel our feelings, to step back from our experience and disidentify from it, simply to witness it. It takes strengths inside, various capabilities such as distress tolerance or steadiness of mind or an internalized sense of allies to be able to just simply be with our own experience. You know, as they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, the mind is a dangerous neighborhood. Never go in alone, right? And so we've got to internalize strengths to just be with our experience. We also need to internalize strengths to do, in my view, the second of the three great ways to engage the mind, to release the negative. You know, to let the feelings drain out of the body, to challenge negative cognitions, to control or ultimately release unwholesome desires. You know, again, we need strengths to let go. And, of course, through the gradual cultivation of strengths, growing the positive inside ourselves, we grow the flowers we want to have in the inner garden of the mind. Now, as a framework here, I think there are these three great ways to engage the mind, to practice, to let be, let go, and let in. I'm going to focus momentarily on letting in this larger context, but I think it's important to appreciate the fact that even if we're moving into choiceless awareness, you know, I'm a longtime meditator, meditation teacher, even moving into some kind of profound state of just simply being with what's there, we also need to have internalized various capabilities that can enable us to do that thing. Okay. So in this context then of talking about inner strengths, I'd like to start with a story I heard about two wolves. And you may have heard the story yourself or perhaps heard it in different ways. The way I heard it was this. A woman was asked toward the end of her life, a Native American First People woman, grandmother, how did you become so happy? How did you become so wise, so effective? Everybody listens to you. Everybody wants to be your friend. How did you actually do it? She paused, she reflected, and she said, you know, I think it's because when I was young, I realized that in my heart were two wolves, one of love and one of hate. And I also realized when I was young that everything depended upon which one I fed each day. I've told that story so often, I'm still getting the shivers every time, you know. The first part, of course, the reality of the wolf of hate, metaphorically speaking, broadly defined, but that capacity in almost every human heart, certainly inside my own, for ill will, envy, vengeance, even violence, that capacity, rage, if you will. And the second takeaway here, which is really relevant for our purposes, is this fundamental idea that we're continually feeding one wolf or another. The brain is continually changing based on our experiences, one way or another. Which wolf will we feed? Will we feed the wolf of love? Will we grow love in our heart? Or other forms of inner strength, right? Inner strengths are a very familiar idea in psychology, as well as in the culture altogether. Love, obviously, is an inner strength, as are various capabilities like the executive functions, mindfulness, impulse control. Inner strengths include positive emotions, as Barbara Fredrickson, I'm really looking forward to her presentation, and her colleagues have so well documented. Positive emotion, happiness, joy. You know, California has no monopoly on positive emotion. Gratitude, gladness, awe, everyday sense of well-being, accomplishment. These positive emotions, besides being pleasant in the moment, confer all kinds of value for people. They make people stronger. They make them more resilient. They make people more able to handle the hard things in life. Also, of course, inner strengths include various attitudes like openness or determination, you know, an approach orientation, optimism, somatic inclinations. As Peter Levine just blew my mind at his lunch address yesterday, talking about inclinations in the body, vitality, relaxation, leaning in rather than back. You know, I learned a while ago with my wife of 31 years that when she had a problem and more it was looking like it was me, that it was better to lean forward in the listening moment rather than lean away, you know, kind of kept my head in the game, you know. That's a somatic inclination too, right? Okay. And then last, of course, the character virtues of all kinds, patience, generosity, thrift. I forget all the Boy Scout character virtues I was supposed to memorize. thrift, something like that. Cleanliness was in there, I think, somewhere. Dispense with that quickly. Wisdom and so on. Okay, so what does it actually take to develop these inner strengths? Well, inner strengths in the modern neuropsychological frame, the natural frame, are understood to be built out of brain structure. Okay, so then the question becomes, very pragmatically, how do we get that good stuff into the brain? Inner strengths are grown in this two-stage process, where essentially we have an experience of them or a related factor, that's a state, which then gets installed in the brain increasingly as a trait. We move essentially from mental states, thoughts, feelings, inclinations, states of mind, emotions, body states, and so forth. We move from states, mental states, to neural traits, from activation to installation, from short-term memory buffers to long-term storage. We grow inner strengths, in short, by experiencing them or related factors and then helping those experiences sink in and gradually weave their way into the fabric of the brain and therefore our life. For example, a child comes to feel securely attached by repeatedly internalizing, installing experiences of feeling seen, valued, responded to, cherished, and prized. An adult, let's say, gradually grows compassion inside herself or himself by repeatedly internalizing, installing experiences of empathy, kindness, a sense of what it's like to walk in another person's shoes, the intention, the wish that beings not suffer, warm-heartedness of various kinds. Or let's say an adult might develop more sense of confidence at work by repeatedly internalizing, installing experiences of accomplishment, of feeling valued by other people, of having a sense of the goodness inside one's own heart. Right? These are the ways in which we grow the good stuff inside ourselves. In a nutshell, without the installation phase, there's no change in the brain. There's no healing. There's no growth. Positive activations, useful, nice, pleasant, what have you, states of mind are great. They're great in the moment. Better than a stick in the eye, but without installation, they don't have any kind of lasting value. All right? And then, meanwhile, negative mental states are being rapidly converted to neural structure due to the negativity bias of the brain. All right? Push my button here. Here we go. So, as Rich alluded to in the very beginning, as our ancestors evolved, the nervous system's been evolving for 600 million years, nested on a foundation of life on the planet, another roughly 3 billion years before that, right? I think of the Grateful Dead lyric, what a long, strange trip it's been. That's kind of the nature of evolution. Down that long run, our ancestors needed to both get carrots, like food, mating opportunities, stuff like that, and they also needed to avoid sticks, like predators, natural hazards, aggression inside their band or between bands, what have you. Okay, both are important, but there's a difference. If you fail to get that carrot today, you'll have a chance at a carrot tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid that stick today, that predator, that aggression in your band or between bands, no more carrots forever. Thus, the brain has acquired what scientists call its innate, its hardwired negativity bias, which manifests in all kinds of ways. At the end of the slide set, I think you have it in your handout or you can access it, I have multiple slides of references. Among them is a great literature review of the research on the negativity bias called Bad is Stronger Than Good. And it has the virtue, which is uncommon among psychology papers, of being really readable and interesting. Bad is stronger than good. Not bad is better than good, but stronger than good. Okay, so we have the negativity bias that shows up in lots of ways. The brain is constantly scanning for danger. Animals back in the day, they were all zen. They read my books and were just super chilling, looking at the light on the water. Chomp! They got eaten, right? They weren't looking around, paranoid, nervous and cranky, right? And the ones who were that way have survived and they passed on their genes and we're their great-grandchildren on top of the food chain, armed with nuclear weapons. That's a thought. Okay, so wherever I was. So there's constantly scanning for bad news. That's the negativity bias. And then if we find anything alarming, anything negative, whoop, we hyperfocus. That's in part of the reason for the power of what Barbara Fredrickson has talked about in terms of broaden and build, because positive experiences, especially positive emotions, widen our view, and as well, they build resources inside us. So negative experiences happen, and we hyper-focus on them, and then we overreact to them. If you play two sounds for a person, equally loud, one is pleasant, one is unpleasant, the brain will react more to the unpleasant one. Or people, for example, are more focused on avoiding losses than exerting the same amount of effort to acquire an equivalent gain. That's why the psychologist Daniel Kahneman got a Nobel Prize in economics for his work on loss aversion, right? Another example of the negativity bias. And then, especially relevant for our purposes, now that the brain has scanned and found the negative, hyper-focused on it, and overreacted to it, whoop, it's fast-tracked into neural structure. Right? That's why we tend to learn faster from pain than pleasure. That's why negative information about other people is more memorable than positive information, thus attack ads in politics. Right? That's why in personal experiences, let's say that there's someone in your life that you work with or live with or sleep with, in my wife's case, all three, and 10 things happen in a day, right? And let's say 9 are positive, 1 is negative. What's the one you think about while you're falling asleep? It's typically the negative one. Think about the brain altogether. It has this dedicated circuitry in which negative experiences, it's important to remember that the same neurohormonal machinery that evolved to enable our ancestors to get away from a charging lion is locked and loaded today when we're stuck in traffic, right? Or we can't get online. Can you believe it? Getting no signal. Yeah. Or, right, we're dealing with a teenager at dinner who's giving us attitude, watch my face. Or trying to get a toddler in a car seat who doesn't want to get there, one of the more stressful experiences known to humankind. Okay, so the same machinery that evolved to get away from those predators is activated today when we're simply upset, when we're irritated or frustrated or anxious about something, or we feel hurt or let down. Well, the stress cascade involves releases of cortisol, as you know, from the adrenal glands, and cortisol moves back up into the brain, where it has a kind of 1-2 punch there. Cortisol in the brain sensitizes the alarm bell of the brain, the amygdala, so now it reacts more readily and more, as it were, loudly, and cortisol overstimulates to the point of potentially eventually killing neurons in the hippocampus, a different part of the brain that performs functions like putting things in context for us so we can see the big picture, realize that it's today, not, when I was a kid. And also the hippocampus inhibits the amygdala. It calms down the amygdala, and the hippocampus tells another part of the brain, the hypothalamus, to quit calling for stress hormones. You can see the vicious cycle. Stress today overstimulates the alarm bell of the brain and weakens regulation upon it and also the capacity to put things in a big picture, which makes us then really vulnerable to stress the day after that, which makes us very reactive the day after that in a vicious cycle. There are no comparable processes of positive sensitization that with such intensely powerful machinery inside the human brain. Okay? So, what's the takeaway? The takeaway is that the negativity bias was good for survival. It was good for passing on genes that pass on genes back in the day. Even today, in really harsh conditions, battlefield conditions, some families feel like a battlefield, growing up in a certain neighborhoods, things like that. Okay, there's a place for the negativity bias. But today, for most people, certainly in the developing parts of the world, with obviously many exceptions, some tragic exceptions, still, on the whole, the negativity bias today is kind of like living in the 21st century with this sort of well-intended universal learning disorder, the result of having a brain that's been painstakingly crafted over literally hundreds of millions of years, ultimately, for survival in Stone Age conditions, all right, set in Central Park here. Our daughter photoshopped this slide. I've got to give her credit, all right? Okay, so what are we going to do, right? In effect, we've got this negativity bias. It's well-intended. It serves certain useful functions occasionally, but on the whole, it means that those little red balls of negative experiences are being quickly and routinely turned into neural structure, and meanwhile, functioning as a kind of bottleneck, the positive experiences, the beneficial experiences, the useful states of mind, the useful perspectives or emotions or bodily states or inclinations, the useful states of mind, the beneficial states of mind, are having a hard time getting converted into neural structure. This means that just having positive experiences is not enough. This has been deeply humbling and disturbing for me as a longtime therapist and someone involved in personal growth, human potential, including spiritual practice, for a long time. In other words, if we don't pay attention to converting these states into traits, they're momentarily pleasant, but they have no lasting value. And I think this is sort of the dirty little secret in psychotherapy. And also in other forms of personal development, personal practice, that most of the hard-won mental states that we call up or our clients work at calling up have no lasting value. I think that's why, as Scott Miller writes here, as he puts it, the same research that proves that therapy works shows no improvement in outcomes over the last 30 or so years. In other words, if you take a look at well-done meta-analyses of therapy outcome research, say 30 years ago, time going this way, and you look at similarly good studies these days in terms of looking at effect sizes, response to treatment, let's say, the data is somewhat noisy, but there's clearly no apparent trend of improvement over 30 years. Why is that? I think it's because over 30 years, we've gotten a lot better at activating beneficial states of mind, but we've gotten no better, more or less, at installing those states of mind inside the brain. Yes, there are many noteworthy exceptions. Individual therapists and individual therapies. I think coherence therapy, somatic experiencing, EMDR, a number of other therapies, focusing, etc., pay explicit attention and really go after the installation phase of learning. But certainly many therapists, me included, you know, have not, in my view, paid sufficient attention to that. What are we going to do about it? I think improving installation is where the real opportunity lies in our field, rather than frankly chasing yet one more glittering beneficial state of mind. We can deliberately use the mind to slow down the learning process, to practice what I call the humility of receptivity, to appreciate the fact that the ancient systems that particularly are involved in emotional memory, motivational memory, attitudinal memory, somatic memory, where really the action is, these ancient systems are slower, frankly. They're older and slower than the pace of glittering thought. We need to have that humility of receptivity to slow the process down a dozen or two dozen or, God forbid, three dozen seconds at a time to really let the good experiences sink in, which is what I call taking in the good, right? So, taking in the good, bottom line, it's about popping open the bottleneck and helping these beneficial experiences that we've activated, so often with a lot of effort, actually sink in, actually turn into neural structure, so there's some kind of learning, there's some kind of lasting value, right? By taking in the good, I mean the deliberate internalization of beneficial experiences in implicit memory. Beneficial experiences are pragmatically defined as those that lead to happiness and welfare for oneself and often other people. Most beneficial experiences are enjoyable. Not always, though. There's a place, I think, for healthy remorse, a place for disenchantment, a place for distress tolerance, and so forth. But on the whole, it's quite remarkable that beneficial experiences are usually enjoyable. And so it's very important to not underestimate the power of enjoyable experiences, because that's often a clue that it would be beneficial for one to really help it sink in. And of course, implicit memory, mostly with taking in the good, I'm not talking about taking mental snapshots of really cool events. Okay, there's a place for that. But I'm really talking about registering the residues of experience, the emotional residue, the motivational state, the inclination, the background perspective or frame of reference for things. That's the territory of implicit memory. Okay? How do we do it? I summarize this process in three steps with an optional fourth one. And I'm actually going to do it experientially with you momentarily, right? Bunch of therapists, I've got to do something experiential. So, first step, this is the activation phase. We have a good experience, typically because we simply notice one we're already having. You know, you're walking through the hallways here and, you know, listening to Rich in your head, you know, your co-pilot, look up, make eye contact. You know, there's a nice moment of connection with someone else. You're having a good experience, right? Well, you're just noticing it. There's also a place for creating positive experiences, for deliberately calling up, let's say, compassion for others, or drawing upon, as I do, kind of the body memory of rock climbing, you know, pulling over some overhang, when I've got to get a sense of determination inside myself to deal with something serious. These positive, beneficial experiences that you're having are typically mild. You know, on the 0 to 10 scale, it's the ones and twos of everyday life. But in a funny way, that makes them really authentic, right? Even though they're mild, there are still opportunities. I think of it as the law of little things. You know, it's like lots of little bad things take us to a bad place, and it's going to be lots of little good things that take us to a better one. And then once you get the positive, beneficial experience going, you're having it, it's activated, you move into the installation phase through enriching it, right? And there we can draw upon one or more of five very well-known factors in the neuropsychology of learning, such as duration, you know, keeping those neurons firing together over a longer period of time so they have more chance to do some wiring together, or getting them firing intensely. Intensity is another major factor of learning. So in addition to preserving the experience, protecting it a dozen, two dozen, three dozen seconds in a row to maximize that transfer from short-term buffers to long-term storage, we can also intensify the experience. Or in terms of multimodality, open to it in the body. Yes, there's a place for useful thoughts, useful perspectives. Somewhere in my mid-20s, I realized that growing up, I had been a nerd, not a wimp. Now, that's a useful insight. That's a good thought. You know, I was president of the dork club, that's for sure. But I was not a wimp. All right? So there's a place for registering good thoughts. But very, you know, on the whole, the most useful learning is emotional learning, you know, is somatic learning, it's attitudinal learning, it's motivational learning. And that's where multimodality comes in, helping the recognition of a good fact become a good experience in the body. Novelty is a fourth factor of enriching, and you don't have to use all of them. You know, one is enough, but the more the better. The brain is a big novelty detector. It's constantly looking for what's new. So looking at or engaging a beneficial experience, including a everyday mild one, with the eyes of a child, or as they say in Buddhism, beginner's mind, Zen mind, you know, seeing it freshly. That's novelty. And then fifth, personal relevance. Why should I care? Why is this salient? Why would it matter to me, for example, to internalize a greater commitment to my own sobriety? Why would it matter to me to develop more capacity to be patient with my children? Why would it matter to me to develop more of a sense of my own worth and goodness, even though I was abused when I was a child? Then we're more motivated to help that experience sink in. And then overlapping the enriching phase, we have absorbing, where based on research that shows that you can prime and sensitize memory systems, we intend and we sense that the experience is sinking into us, becoming a part of us. People do this in various ways. I'm pretty visual. I'll visualize the experience coming in like water into a sponge, or I'll feel it as some kind of warmth entering into me, perhaps like a soothing balm going down inside or filling up hollow, empty places where one was shorted. With children, I'll talk about putting a jewel in the treasure chest of the heart. This whole approach of having, enriching, and absorbing can be likened almost to a fire. In the first step, having, we light the fire, or we notice that it's already burning. In the second step, enriching, we protect the fire. We don't let the rain put it out too quickly. We don't skitter on to the next thing so fast. We stay with it, or we add logs to it even to help it burn more brightly. And then in the third step, we warm ourselves at the fire. We absorb the experience and let it sink in. You know, it's interesting, like I can be, and probably still am, a fairly heady guy. And one of the things that's been true for me in my deep dive into the neuropsychology of learning, is it's brought me home to an intimacy with my own body, to a kind of gentle, kind receptivity and yielding and protecting, so that these useful experiences can actually land and have some kind of lasting value. Okay. And then, if you want, the fourth step, which is to link positive and negative material together. For example, one could have an experience of feeling cared about, prominent in awareness, maybe something happened at work or here at the symposium, feeling cared about. And then what one can do is bring into awareness perhaps old feelings of not being so cared about. And by keeping the positive experience of feeling cared about prominent in awareness, since neurons that fire together wire together, gradually the positive experience can associate with or will associate with that negative material, potentially soothing it, easing it, and even eventually replacing it. Okay? Now, usually, let me just So, if you summarize it, okay? This gives us an acronym, HEAL. Have, enrich, absorb, and link. That's the totality of the essence, really, of taking in the good, this deliberate internalization of beneficial experiences in implicit memory. It sounds kind of complicated, right? But in its essence, it boils down to four words. Have it, enjoy it. In other words, have the useful experience in the first place, and then in particular, don't waste it on the brain. Help it sink in by enjoying it. Or to really summarize it, mobetta, right? More episodes of, you know, having that 10, 20, 30 second registration of a useful experience, and inside those episodes, more depth of engagement, more openness in the body, more receptivity to the experience altogether. Any single time we do it won't, you know, necessarily change our mind, change our life altogether, but the gradual accumulation of these little moments can really add up over time. Typically, we take in the good on the fly, kind of half a dozen times a day, maybe a moment here, an opportunity there, rather than just wasting it. And there's a place for taking in the good at more formal moments, such as at the end of a therapy session, or a classroom with children, or at a meal, or at the end of meditating, or Pilates, or some kind of workout, or upon first waking, or just before sleep. So, want to try it? Why not? All right, so let's try it, okay? So, this is experiential practice. It's internal. You can skip it entirely if you want. Feel free to ignore everything I say and just sort of space out. Check your emails. It's really okay. I won't be taking any names or numbers. Don't worry about it. So let's just try it. It's a little artificial. Normally, we take in the good, like I said, 10, 20, 30 seconds at a time. I'll take a couple minutes with this. If you can, see if you can start to have some experience of compassion. With your eyes open or closed, bring to mind someone you care about, especially someone that you wish that this person would not suffer. It could be subtle. You wish this person were not so stressed, so pressured, burdened, perhaps something very, very intense, some really intense form of suffering. Whatever it is, in your heart, sincerely, you wish that this being not suffer. And then as you open to the experience, moving into enriching it, helping it last, if your mind wanders, that's fine. In the language of meditation, this is a micro-concentration practice where you seek to become absorbed in some kind of positive experience. Feeling compassion in your body. Meanwhile, absorbing it, getting a sense of compassion sinking into you while you sink into it. There might even be a subtle sense of kind of budging around it, giving over to compassion, letting yourself become just a little bit more compassionate altogether as a result of this practice. Okay, so come on back. it's perfectly fine to keep feeling compassion, including for me. You know. Anyway, I never thought of that before, but okay, moving right along. So anyway, so it's probably felt pretty good. It is amazing, isn't it? You know, several thousand people, a couple minutes of deliberate practice, the room changes. Feels very different. You know, and that's taking in the good altogether. It's a deceptively simple practice, but it has a lot of benefits. I think there are three fundamental kinds of benefits for this practice. One is that we install particular strengths we want to grow inside ourselves. That's the first bullet point up there. We grow the particular flowers we want in the garden of the mind, both in general and in particular, which I'll talk about a little bit later, especially in my workshop. The second major kind of benefit of taking in the good is implicit. In other words, built in to taking in the good is a stance of treating yourself like you matter, among other implicit benefits. And that stance of treating oneself like one matters is important in general, but it's especially important, of course, if you haven't felt like you've mattered enough to others. And then the third kind of benefit for taking in the good is that gradually over time, new research is beginning to suggest that much as the brain can become increasingly sensitized for negative experiences, so it learns ever more rapidly from them, with deliberate practice of the internalization of positive experiences, it's possible that the brain might become increasingly sensitized to positive experiences, so it becomes more efficient and more effective at turning them into neural structure, thus learning from the beneficial experiences of everyday life. In sum, this activation-installation cycle is the universal essence of psychological healing, everyday well-being and effectiveness, personal growth, and spiritual practice, at least inside the natural frame. I did not invent the heal steps. This is not my personal invention. Other people have talked about this kind of thing, sometimes explicitly, often more implicitly. Nonetheless, as Orwell wrote, you know, to see what is in front of one's nose takes a constant struggle. And in terms of my own practice as a psychotherapist, as well as more generally in terms of, you know, healing my own wounds, it's been very useful for me to appreciate the importance, the primacy, the centrality of the installation phase of learning, without which there's no lasting value, to really face up to the implications of the negativity bias, the ways in which it makes, as I put it, our brain like Velcro for bad experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. And it's also been very important to me to learn how to do and explore how to do these heal steps really effectively and skillfully, and then also apply them to particular situations of various kinds. So, kind of quickly here, that's why I created a course on taking in the good. We did some research on it through UC Berkeley recently. It's an 18-hour course that's formatted in different ways. Happily, oh my God, what a relief. We actually had positive results. You know, it would have been very embarrassing if we had like non-significant findings. Anyway, and so we actually did a good study, waitlist, randomized control group model, and so forth. And we found, as you can see in the slide here, and I'll move through this quickly, that people who'd been trained to learn how to take in the good compared to randomized waitlist matched controls, the people who'd gone through the course reported more contentment, self-esteem, and other good things. And then when we let the waitlist people take the course, they were mad because they had to wait 4 months to take the course. When they got to take the course, and then we had a larger sample, which gave us more statistical power, we found that compared to where people were before they took the course, after the course, and at 2 month follow-up, that's a pretty good finding, that going through this process, learning how to do this and apply it to particular issues, led to people reporting and experiencing, hopefully, more love, compassion, self-control, self-worth, and less anxiety and depression. I have a couple pretty pictures. More self-esteem, that's good. Less depression and anxiety, that's good. I should add that in 2015, I'm going to offer this course much more widely and start training people to teach it. So if that has any interest to you, you can find out more on my website. So, moving to the final stretch, right? I want to kind of make two fundamental points based on stepping back and looking at the big picture here about activation, installation, taking in the good. The first is to think about how we can look for those particular experiences and grow those particular strengths inside ourselves that would make all the difference in the world. All right? And as a model for thinking about that, I draw upon our evolutionary history, especially of the brain, and Paul MacLean's model here of the triune brain, related work, Dan Siegel and others have talked about, what really, in my own adaptation of it, boils down to three fundamental needs that all animals have for safety, satisfaction, and connection that are managed by three overarching systems in the brain that help us avoid harms, approach rewards, and attach to others. And these needs and these overarching systems, avoiding, approaching, and attaching, are loosely associated with the reptilian brainstem, early mammalian subcortical, and later mammalian, especially primate, and especially human, stages of evolution. All right? So if you think about it, and I'll get into this. So here's a framework right here. If a person has a need in a particular system, they need medicine, they need inner medicine, they need soul food that will address that particular need. To tell a quick story about myself, when I grew up, I grew up in a safe environment, middle class, suburban setting, Southern California. I didn't have big issues growing up around safety. Also growing up, I learned fairly early how to get off my parents' radar. That's an important skill. And so I could accomplish my various nefarious goals. Also, I was successful in school. So I didn't have a lot of issues around failure. I didn't experience any shocking losses. In terms of my needs for satisfaction, managed by the approaching reward system. But I grew up in a home with loving parents who were bad at empathy. That's an interesting combination. I don't think it's unique to me. And also, I was very young going through school because I skipped a grade and I have a very late birthday. So I had lots of experiences of feeling left out, excluded. Aha, issues in the connection system. So when I finally got to college, you know, I realized that I could try to make myself feel safer and strong, whatever. That was nice, but it didn't reach my need. It wasn't the medicine my heart needed. Or I could accomplish more. You know, I could become even more successful. Nice, but it didn't address the hole in my own heart. It's only when I started appreciating the importance of everyday experiences of feeling included, seen, wanted, a girl would smile at me in the elevator, oh my God, some stud athlete would throw me the ball in intramural football and say, good catch, Hanson, I'm going to throw to you more often. Oh, thank you, thank you. Yeah, let it sink in. Bit by bit, right? Drop by drop, I was filling that hole in my heart. So I'll talk more about this a lot later, but this for me is a very useful model to think about, okay, what are the antidote experiences or the key resource experiences? If you have scurvy, you need vitamin C. Iron's good, but it doesn't address your need. So you might ask yourself, personally, what's your vitamin C these days? Right? Or what's a key resource to develop inside someone that you care about or are working with currently in treatment? Or, to put it in a funny kind of way, thinking about the inner menagerie, the inner zoo that's inside all of us, you know, the reptilian, mammalian, and, you know, primate stages of evolution, what do we need to do? What do you need to do? What do our clients need to do, right? To pet the lizard, little brain stem, all right? Soothing, calming, safety. Feed the mouse, right? Reward experiences. I originally thought feed the rat because I like rats, but there's something culturally about rats, so I went to mouse, feed the mouse, reward experiences, gratitude, gladness, and so forth. And of course, hug the monkey. There are four monkeys in this picture. See the little eyeball in there, the little two eyes? Okay, great. All right. I do feel like I've got all these creatures inside my head, and I'm very fond of lizards. You know, I grew up with them, and lizards need petting too. Okay, so that was my first kind of step back consideration. What's your vitamin C? What are the key resource experiences that are really going to make a big difference, and then how can a person activate and then especially install those experiences? And I'll explore that a lot more, including its clinical applications, in my workshop later. Second big step back is to ask the question, is this focus on positive experiences, beneficial experiences, which are usually enjoyable, is this just another form of craving? Just another form of grasping after, you know, happiness? Is this merely some kind of California fad? And for me, that's a very legitimate question for all kinds of reasons, including the fact that as someone with a real background in Buddhism, it really matters. Because in that frame of reference, that model, it's seen that, you know, going to war with what's painful, chasing after what's pleasurable, clinging to what's heartfelt, craving, broadly defined, is a primary, if not the primary, cause of suffering. That's why I think it's very helpful to think about the ways in which actually over time, cultivation, the gradual cultivation of wholesome qualities, inner strengths, broadly defined, in the heart, in the body, in the mind, the gradual cultivation of that actually undoes craving. Because if you think about it, what are the causes of craving? Right? Craving, in a neuropsychological, evolutionary neuropsychological framework, craving is a drive state based on an underlying sense of deficit or disturbance. Right? That's the operationalization in neuropsychological terms of the second noble truth in Buddhism, the craving that causes suffering. What does it actually take to move into the third noble truth, as it were, the possibility of bringing this craving to an end or at least dramatically reducing it? So we move through life increasingly undisturbed. We're engaging life. We're definitely engaging life fully. You know, we're cheering on our sports teams. We're speaking truth to power. We're dealing with the hard things. But we do so in a much more even way, sometimes described as walking evenly over uneven ground. Well, if we repeatedly, again and again and again, I think of it 10,000 times, 10 seconds at a time, if we repeatedly internalize the felt sense of those core needs being met for safety, satisfaction, and connection, gradually over time, we fill up our own holes in the heart so there's less and less basis for deficit or disturbance. That's not itself enlightenment, but it's a very important neuropsychological basis for it. So then to really step back and kind of, you know, move to a close here, I'd like to ask you a question. What's the most important minute of your life? I think about it, I think it's the next one. Right? We can't do anything about the minutes in the past. More than a few minutes in the future, we start losing influence. But the next minute, the minute that's right in front of our nose, right under our nose all the time, that's the most important minute of our life. What will we do with the most important minute of our life? What will we help our clients do with the most important minute in their lives? Right? Will we make use of the good that actually is present in the most important minute of our life, at least a few times a day, or will we waste it? You know, as they say in Tibet, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves. All right? Gradually, bit by bit, we can use what's present in, what's available to us. It's simply a matter of harvesting the opportunities that are present in the most important minute of our lives. And do not underestimate the power of the effect of this gradually accumulating over time. As the Buddha said a long time ago, he says, "Think not lightly of good, saying, it will not come to me. Drop by drop is the water pot filled." Likewise, the wise one, gathering it little by little, fills oneself with good. So in the same way, may you and I and all beings gradually fill ourselves with good for our own sake and that of the whole wide world. So thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. I like you. Oh, thank you. Oh. Thank you. Thank you. Take it in, take it in. Thank you. Beautiful. Well, take care.